having some technical difficulties. I had not read the passage in the Bible envisioning them dragging the Lord this kind of distance, but it was a fair piece that they must have dragged the Lord. I don't know if they were dragging him or pulling him along, but anyway. Somewhere in Nazareth, the ancient well still exists from which Jesus would have drank. I wished we could have seen that, but we didn't have time for that. As we hiked up this hillside, I couldn't help thinking of the Lord Jesus running through here as a boy, walking all over these very stones as he explored, like we all did as children. This was the Lord's childhood haunt, if you will. We finally came to the end of the promontory, and that's looking towards some of the new city of Nazareth. The new city wraps around on the tops of these hills. And that's looking basically southwest toward Mount Carmel. This promontory looks directly down onto the northern side of the Jezreel Megiddo Valley, something I hadn't thought of before, that Nazareth was right here at the top half of the Jezreel Valley. This is looking east. There is Mount Tabor in the distance, where Deborah and Barak started the campaign against Sisera. Deborah ordered the battle from the top of that little mountain there, little hill. Turning south of Tabor is the hill of Moreh, the town of Nain, where Jesus raised the widow's son. The town of Nain is on its north, on this side of that hill. And Endor, where Saul visited the witch, is on its eastern side. Mount Gilboa, eastern side would be the far side from this picture. Mount Gilboa is mostly hidden beyond that hillside. And then we turn south, directly south, and take a picture here out into the Jezreel Valley. Somewhere near the foot of Mount Moreh, or the hill of Moreh, the river Kishon flows toward the Mediterranean Sea. So that's where the river Kishon is down there. Again, this is the southwesterly view. On the sign, the second item from the left, there is pointing out something that they're calling Jael's tent. Jael's tent. It's right here in this little square on the picture. We didn't get to visit it. I'm not sure what it is, but it's no doubt another tourist attraction. Here's a closer view of Mount Tabor, where Deborah and Barak started the battle, and a closer view of the hill of Moreh. Luke 4:28-30 says, "And all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath, and rose up and thrust him out of the city, and led him unto the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong. But he, passing through the midst of them, went his way." It's a lot rockier than my pictures, the ones where, you know, I'm standing on the hillside. It's a lot rockier than my pictures show, but Brother Rogerson's picture shows it a lot better from his drone. And so anybody who is thrown off this had very little chance of surviving. It's a tall hill, too. And here we have a video. Let's see if we can get it to play. That's the town of Nazareth, modern city. Much bigger than the old town was. Jezreel Valley. Hard to get good pictures with that many people in the group, by the way. So whenever I have a picture without people, it's amazing. There's Mount Tabor again. The hill of Moreh. And again, the Kishon River is down there somewhere. Our next stop was the Nazareth Village, funded by a Christian group. I forget what group per se. But it was right in the heart of modern Nazareth. That building up the hillside is a hospital. This property used to be part of the hospital that the Christians founded, and then they separated this property. But anyway, the tour guide at the village gave a great little explanation of every different scene that they had there. Here he's talking about olive trees, and not all of these trees are olive trees. Some of these trees would have been almond trees. The almond trees were blooming, but he's talking about different trees there, that we find in Israel. And the volunteers in this little village were dressed as authentically as they could in first century attire. Here we have a shepherd and his fold. I forget the name of the shepherd. They named them with some Bible names. Here's a recreation of a well-to-do family tomb. Not a super rich tomb, but a well-to-do family tomb. Only well-to-do people were able to afford building tombs. The poor people were just buried. And this is a picture inside that tomb. They said it took a month to carve this tomb out with modern tools and equipment. Imagine how long it would take by hand with just a hammer and chisel. And as they were building this village, the Nazareth village, they discovered an authentic ancient wine press right on their own site. And that big hole in the picture is the drain where the wine would drain into. The upper side, there's a carved out area. You can maybe see it better in this picture. There's a carved out square area there where you would put the grapes. The grapes would be placed in the upper cutout area and trampled. The juice would flow through the narrow channel right there into the lower vat, and then it would sit in that vat for many days as it cured probably into wine. If they were making grape juice, they would harvest it right away, but if they were making wine, it would sit in that vat. They explained that terraced farms were very important in this hilly terrain in Israel, but the terraces were also very expensive to buy or to build. So expensive that more than one family could own a portion of just one terrace. And so this whole area could have been owned by most of the town of ancient Nazareth, this size of area. Here we have the vine dresser in his vineyard. These are live grape vines that have not blossomed yet. It's hard to see the actual vines because mostly you're seeing the structure that the vines hang off of. These terraces could have been owned again by three or more families with this communal path through their little farms. Very expensive terraced area. Close to the olive yard, we came to their recreation of an olive press. And this is a video.
So, olives are going to be crushed. And as he walks many times like this, everything turns into such olive mash pulp, which is very oily, so it is all together. Olives, of course, seeds, yeah, water, olive oil. We haven't got any oil yet, so that's why people would place this olive mash at the sides of this special round basket. So these baskets only allow water and oil out while the pulp stays in. And once they got about 8-10 baskets like this, please, let's come over that part of the building.
So they put the olives in that press or masher, and they get a pulp. They wouldn't have any olive oil yet. They take that mash, scrape that mash out, and put it in the baskets. And they'd make a stack of baskets, and then they would put the baskets under something like this and press them.
Over a hole, which is half meter deep, and without any pressure applied, water with oil would flow down to that hole. After a while, water, which is heavier, would go down, and oil just floats on the top. People would scoop it out later on. That was the first olive oil of the best quality, and it is considered to be the first fruits.
All right, let's see if we can get a better picture of the olive oil lever press. And so the baskets were placed near the far end where the pole goes into the wall, close to that area. And they were then pressed by these waits, the rock waits. And that's when they would get the olive oil squeezed out of the mash. Moving on through this first century village, we came to the potter's house, and he wrought on his wheel for us.
Shaping in order to make it smooth.
Notice the big kick wheel underneath the table where his foot periodically kicks that to spin the whole thing. That's how it's powered. There's no motor there. It's all by manpower. Next to the potter's house was the potter's kiln, where he fired all of his pottery to make it hard. And inside the potter's shop, of course, were all of his pottery wares. So they made this place as authentic as they could. Very neat place. If you ever are there, I encourage you to visit it. Our next visit was to none other than Joseph's carpentry shop. Even though this Joseph was not related to our Mary in the Bible in any way, he did have a great workshop. We also learned that a carpenter in Bible times very often worked with stone as well as wood. And so sometimes when the Bible talks about a carpenter, it's also referring to a mason. When the Bible talks about a mason, it could be a carpenter that it's talking about. Then we visited none other than Mary. Again, we're naming these against the Bible names, of course. She was busy making yarn and weaving it. Mothers in Bible times could take raw wool, work it into yarn, dye it with many different vegetables mostly. That's the cheap way of coloring the yarn. And then they could weave all or most of the clothes needed for their own family. The mothers taught their daughters how to do all of that. Then we dropped by the local synagogue for their service. Notice the high windows designed to give light and the benches around the perimeter. A tremendous message was preached that day, but you weren't there to hear it. Too bad. Not really. But anyway, then we headed back behind Mount Tabor, drove back behind Mount Tabor back to the Sea of Galilee area. In the distance, we saw the Arbel Pass there, where we would be later that evening. The cliffside there is the Arbel Pass. We arrived at Magdala and got to see the first century synagogue ruins. Our Lord would have preached within these very walls, almost for sure. This is the original centerpiece stone. Perhaps it was used as the Elijah seat. But this stone would have heard the voice of the Son of God as he preached in Magdala. He could have even sat on this stone as he taught. They know this room was used at the time of Christ because a Roman coin was found at this depth with the equivalent date of AD 29 stamped right on it. So this room was being used at the time of Christ. The center stone in the background of the picture there, the center stone in the ruins is a recreation of the one under the glass, so they just made a fake one and put it there where it would have been. But the mosaic is the floor, is the actual floor Christ saw and walked on. So very neat to see this place. Did I go the wrong way? I must have gone the wrong way. And then we went out to the sea. The lake there, looking south down the western shore of the Sea of Galilee from the harbor at Magdala. Tiberias, the city of Tiberias, is in the distance on the right as we start to pan east here. Mark 4:37-39 says, "And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship, so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on a pillow. And he arose and rebuked the wind and said unto the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm." Hard to imagine this sea being so violent, but it does get violent storms. And there, here we panned all the way to the northern side of the lake there. And so that's the Sea of Galilee. Turning inland, this is the shore view surrounding Magdala. Again, we're panning. There's the Arbel Pass, that cliff that we saw earlier. The Arbel Pass is west of Magdala. That pass is the main road, the ancient main road, not the main road today, but the ancient main road leading to Nazareth from Galilee. It'd be the fastest way to get there. Here's some of the ruins of Magdala. This would be in the production and housing area. So this could have been a fish market, or it could have been a house. Again, Magdala. A mosaic that they found there. Close-up view of that mosaic. And then we headed to the northern end of the lake to visit Capernaum. This is the Tabgha Cove. This is the likeliest spot. We didn't get out and explore. This is a picture taken as we drove by. This is the likeliest spot that we know about that where Jesus would have sat in a boat off the shore and preached to the multitudes. He would have chosen this spot because that cove makes a natural amphitheater to project his voice. This is the other side of the road from the cove. That's the hill above Tabgha, and that's probably the location of the Sermon on the Mount in the distance there. Then we got to Capernaum, the main town of Jesus' ministry. Matthew 11, 21-22 says, "Woe unto thee, Chorazin! Woe unto thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you." It goes on, Matthew 11 goes on and says, "And thou, Capernaum, which art exalted unto heaven, shalt be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which have been done in thee had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I say unto you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for thee." Today all three of those towns that Jesus cursed lie in ruins as a mute testimony to the authority and power of Christ. Even though Capernaum was on the main route, a main Roman road, and physically speaking, it should have been rebuilt because of the perfect spot, it still lies in ruins because of the curse Jesus put on it. I wish I had gotten a picture of this whole building here, but I'm going to show you pieces of it. So this is the left side. This is the center. It's built on piers and is supposed to resemble a boat. It's a Catholic church built over the legendary house of Peter to preserve it while not disturbing the ruins. So it's just sitting there on these piers over the ruins underneath of it. The Bible tells us that Peter's house was near the synagogue. You could enter Peter's house directly after leaving the synagogue. Mark 1:29 tells us, "And forthwith, that means directly, immediately. And forthwith, when they were come out of the synagogue, they entered into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John." And this picture here shows the edge of the Catholic church over Peter's house and the pink and white marble of the newer synagogue built over the ancient synagogue. And so this could actually be the right spot. It's close enough to the synagogue. The ancient house of Peter was apparently very quickly turned into a church in the first and second centuries. In the fourth century, walls were put around his property to set it apart from the town. And so the original drawing are on the right-hand side, the original drawing of it. And then this would be the center two pictures are the second editions. And this is the last editions. And the blue is the original, green is the second edition, and the orange is the final edition. So the original house is on the top right in this picture. At the same time as the walls were built, the 4th century Christians added an arch and an atrium to their church house. The blue in the lower drawing is original again, the green is the addition, along with the top middle picture. And then lastly, in the 5th century, they built an octagonal church on top of the old house. The drawings on the left and the orange on the bottom show those changes. I show you that because it's hard, very hard to tell what you're looking at underneath the Catholic Church. It's quite hard to tell what all these different wall sections are. Okay? The lowest layer of walls are the original house of Peter, supposedly anyway. The octagon church walls is what stands out the most to you. So you're seeing a 5th century ruined church building there mostly. But the lowest walls are the old house walls. Many scholars believe Jesus lived in Peter's house with Peter's family. The Bible is silent on the matter, but the idea is just as good as another. So they might be right. He very well could have lived in Peter's house. This is Capernaum's, what they call the White Synagogue. It was built in the late 4th century AD, and it was built directly over and enlarging the old synagogue of Christ's day. That synagogue, a centurion had built, if you remember. A centurion had built that for the city of Capernaum. In one corner of this white synagogue, excavators left this area exposed to show the black foundation stones of the synagogue Christ preached in. So way down low is the cornerstones of the first synagogue. John 6:58-59, "This is that bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers did eat manna and are dead. He that eateth of this bread shall live forever. These things said he in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum." Capernaum was the center of millstone production in northern Israel. It's evidenced today by the millstones scattered all throughout the ruins. Here's a closer-up view. Those conical-shaped stones are all millstones. So this right here is an upper and nether millstone stacked on top of each other. There's a conical lower millstone, another lower millstone, another piece of a millstone over there. So they're just scattered throughout here. It was in Capernaum, of course, that Jesus said, "And whosoever shall offend one of these little ones that believe in me, it is better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were cast into the sea." I haven't seen any zodiac signs. I didn't when I was there. I haven't still. Any zodiac signs or pentagrams in ruins at the time of Christ. But again, this city was built fancier in the 5th century, 4th and 5th centuries. And so there's a Star of David, if you can see it. Star of David right here on this old piece of rock. And this is the recreation of what's here. As the Star of David evidence is here, by the 4th century, zodiac signs and pentagrams had all been integrated into Judaism. The Star of David is actually a satanic symbol, which is why I'm talking about it that way. But it's been adopted as the Israel insignia. Here is the view of the lake from Capernaum, from the parking lot there. This is what Jesus would have seen quite a bit. After Capernaum, we headed around the lake to circumference it. Go all the way around it. This is the northern inlet of the Jordan leading into the Sea of Galilee. So this is the river coming down from Mount Hermon. We stopped at the only place in biblical Decapolis, which is the Golan today, where there's a steep hill, the only place where there is a steep hill leading directly into the lake. Everything else, the hillsides are set back from the lake. This is the only spot where there's a hill that goes pretty much right down into the lake. This has to be the spot where the pigs ran down the hillside into the lake. Also remember that the lake was a few feet deeper at the time of Christ. They've been losing water since they've been draining the lake and the river for irrigation purposes. Mark 5:13 says, "And forthwith Jesus gave them leave, and the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea. They were about 2,000, and were choked in the sea." At the end of this, I'll try to show a video, Brother Rogerson's aerial shot of this. It shows how steep it is quite a bit better. But anyway, that's the only spot that the hill goes right down into the lake. Back at the southern end of Galilee, this is the outlet now of the Jordan, leading out of the Sea of Galilee down into the Dead Sea. From this water, the nation of Jordan pulls a good deal, and so by the time the river gets way down south, it's smaller than it is right here. So this is basically the largest point of the Jordan River today. Lastly, for the day, we went up into the beginning of the Arbel Pass. Again, it's the pass leading to Nazareth from Magdala. This is between Mount Arbel. This picture is taken between Mount Arbel and Mount Nittai. Mount Nittai is center in the picture there. So Jesus would have walked between these two mountains to get to and from Nazareth, going to Capernaum. This is Mount Arbel. It was used as a fortress during the Maccabean Revolt and the other Jewish revolts that followed that later on in the first and second centuries. And from this point, it's just about 27 miles to Nazareth. That's all, just 27 miles. So let me show you this. We've seen this before, but now that you've seen my pictures, maybe it'll be a little bit more impressive or how things congeal better to you.
In all the world. Rejoice, O Christian, lift up your voice and sing. Eternal hallelujahs to Jesus Christ the King, the hope of all who seek Him, the help of all who find. None other is so loving, so good and kind. He lives, Christ Jesus lives today. He walks with me and talks with me along life's narrow way. He lives, salvation to impart. You ask me how I know He lives.
Find that online if you're interested. But anyway, that was the Arbel Pass was the end of the day. Does anybody have any questions about what you saw there?